guys are very fortunate in that the physics majors have a thing going on where they're willing to actually help students in their classes. And so I'll let these two ladies tell you all about it.
Hi, we're from the Society of Physics Students. I'm Christine Lewski, I'm the Physics Outreach Coordinator. I'm Sarah, I'm the Physics Outreach Secretary. Can you guys hear us okay? So basically, we have free physics tutoring in the POA. That's the Physics Optics Astronomy Library. It's the third floor of Bausch & Lomb. So if you ever need help with homework or preparing for any exams, we offer tutoring from 7 to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday. And so, you know, we're really happy to help. Honestly, we sometimes like your problems better than ours anyways. So we offer tutoring. So we just want to let you know about that.
Want to hand out. All right, so they're going to hand out some information about that. It is a pretty useful thing to take advantage of. I am going to have my TA schedule office hours scattered throughout the week, but these are already set for you, and we'll try to have the TA office hours not exactly overlapping with this. So at any given time during the week, I hope that you'll have someone that you can go to ask questions when they come up. So, okay, other things are, I sent out the email a little while ago, but I'll go ahead and mention it here. I now have a mapping of which TA is going to cover which section, and that's relevant for today because I want you to hand in your problem sets in the lockers that are across the hallway from Bausch & Lomb 106. And if you look at those lockers, you'll see slots that are labeled with different TA names. And what you want to do is to look and see which section that you're registered for, and then hand in your homework in that TA's slot. Okay? Any questions about that? All right. So you've been assigned workshop sections in part because we want to keep the size of the workshop sections about right, or as small as we can make them. And that's really partly because of the rooms and stuff that we're in. But the main reason is that I want those sections as small as we can sort of afford to make them, because most of you are more comfortable asking questions and things in a smaller environment. And the whole focus in workshop is for you to get in there and be comfortable and ask your questions, okay? If you find that you're in there and you're reluctant to talk or you're reluctant to ask your questions because there are other people in the room, then I want you to understand that means that as far as you personally are concerned, that workshop is completely broken, okay? You need to be asking your questions. You need to be talking. And that's the place for you to do that. So I would like the sections to stay roughly equal and smallish, and that's why we have the caps on them. So I would like you to give it a good go. Now, having said that, I do understand some weeks something will happen. You have some event that's going to conflict with some section you're in. I'm fine if you go to a different section that week. I don't want you to look at it and go, I can't make my section, so I'm not going to go this week. That's absolutely not the right thing to do. So just go and find some other section and go to. My TAs will be instructed and just keep track of whoever shows up. If you find that there is something in the dynamics of your particular workshop section, and although we'll have about 15 students or 12 students or something in each section, it's very interesting, depending on the time of the week, the time of the day, and just who's in the section, the dynamics in the different sections can be quite different. So if you find that the dynamics in one of your sections is such that you really aren't getting anything out of it, okay, maybe you're quiet and you like to process things a little bit, and you've got five students in there who have an ego trip and want to blurt out answers before you ever have a chance to even think about it, okay? If that is happening and your TA can't rein them in, then you may just want to try switching sections, okay? But I'd like to discourage you just from willy-nilly going from section to section. I mean, give your section a good go, okay? So I'm hoping not that many of you will feel the need to do that. But fundamentally, in the end, you need to find something that works for you, and you sort of have my blessing to do that. If for whatever reason something's at an ideal time and you just want to go, and there starts to be a lot of people in that section, it's going to break the section for all of us. So, okay, any questions on any of that? Okay. Okay, so last time we talked a little bit about what we call Coulomb's law, which basically describes the electrical force between two charged particles. And we've already talked a lot about its basic form, so I'm not going to say very much about that right now. Last time we also discussed the fact that electric charge is conserved, and it will be conserved in anything that you're doing this semester. We're not going to violate that at all. And electric charge is quantized, and is quantized in units of what we call E here, which is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. So these just happen to be facts of nature, or experimentally observed aspects of nature, which we're just going to take as given, okay? And we then applied basically Coulomb's law to a simple example, which is the hydrogen atom, a proton which we assume is at rest, and an electron which goes around in a circle. And what you'll find is this is the Bohr model of the atom, which I hope you've seen in chemistry before, if you haven't before. Since you assume it's a circle, then you know that there has to be a centripetal force toward the center. The force that's relevant is the electrostatic attraction between these two particles. We ignore the fact that the electron's actually moving. We still think of it as an electrostatic situation. And so the centripetal force becomes the size of the Coulomb attraction to the proton here. And we set that equal to what we know it needs to be because you're on a circle, which is mv squared over r. And from that, we calculated what v was using the various constants when you look them up in the NKS system. And when you plug in the numbers, you find that the particle moves about the speed of light in this circular orbit. And oh, that is really not cool. So one of the things I try to do is, when I do my reviews, is I put in some pre-prepared slides so I don't waste a lot of time on it. And my laptop periodically throws a wrinkle into my system, which blanks out certain slides in some random fashion. So it's not worth our effort in reconstructing that too much at the moment. Let's just remind us a little bit what we did. We took this physical system with the proton and the electron, and I wanted to know how much energy it takes to remove the electron. So you grab onto the electron, and you move it out to infinity. And to determine the energy it takes to do that, you can calculate the work it takes to move it from a radius, which is called the Bohr radius, which is sort of the radius of the circle we're talking about, out to infinity. And I'm not going to repeat the calculation because we did it last time, but when you do this calculation, putting the Coulomb force in for F and moving it directly along the radius, so it's easy to think through what's going on between the force and the ds. S is sort of this generic thing I'm going to use as a path length, okay? And it has a direction at any given moment because it's tangential to the path. In this case, I specify I'm moving out along the radius, which means this ds becomes a dr, all right? And the dot product that's relevant when you want to calculate the work is you have to think about the force. We're calculating the force I have to put in, the work I do in order to move this charged particle out to infinity. And to do that, I have to think, what force do I put in? What force I put in is going to be the force which is equivalent to the force with which it's being pulled toward the proton. So it's the Coulomb force. That's what I have to hold the electron with as I slowly pull it out to infinity. Okay? I don't pull it with more force because then I'm accelerating it, and that's a different sort of problem. I'm not trying to do that. So what you do is you simply basically ask, what force do I have to exert to balance out the force that's going toward the center, and then move it slowly out to infinity. So that means this F is a force that's pointing out this way, because that's the direction in which I'm exerting the force to move the electron out there. Dr is something that increases going out that way. So F dot dr becomes F times dr, because the dot product has the vectors in the same direction. All right. So that's a positive number. And then I integrate. This is now kqq over r squared, and you do the integral of 1 over r squared to get minus 1 over r. And so you can evaluate this. And so we did that last time. I'm not going to drag you through in any more detail than we're currently doing. What we found was that the amount of work was 26.9 electron volts. And that number is high, and that number is high because in this assumption, I've only calculated the amount of work it takes to remove the electron from this position out to infinity, but that assumes that everything is at rest here, when in fact, the electron is moving, and we calculated its velocity. So you start out with the kinetic energy already. So you take this total energy that you have here, and you remove that kinetic energy to get the amount of energy you have to now put into the system to remove the electron, which is the ionization energy. And when we did that, we actually calculated, using this simple model, that the ionization energy was something like 13.3 electron volts, and the actual number is 13.6 electron volts. So I do this calculation in part to remind you that you can't forget about everything you've learned in Physics 113. Work and energy are still work and energy, even though we're going to be talking about charges instead of balls moving most of the time. So you're sort of stuck with that. I'm sorry for that. This class would be a whole lot easier if we could sort of start clean, but unfortunately, if you had issues with work in Physics 113, it'd be good to sort of straighten those out, because we'll be doing a whole lot with it in this class. The other reason I do it is because I sort of find it amusing that we can know effectively nothing much about electromagnetism, and then we can calculate something that is of such fundamental importance to chemistry and the world around us, such as the ionization energy of hydrogen. So I actually think that's pretty cool. And you can get, that's pretty close to the actual number when you go measure. So I find that interesting. Anyway, so that's more or less where we ended up last time. So, electrostatics is a vector force. And we need to take that into account when we calculate the force due to different things. So what that means is if we have a discrete system, and maybe let me take a step back for just a moment. So physics seeks to quantify and sort of understand the natural world around us. Okay? And so you may sometimes get a bit annoyed at all this discussion about forces and everything. What you would like to be able to do is to take the universe as you see it, whatever it is, and to be able to know how it will evolve. And if you know how it will evolve, then you can sort of claim that you understand something about what's going on, right? And so, if you know the position and mass and force that's on a particle, right, as a function of time, then you know exactly how to calculate where it will be in the future. So, in a sense, worrying about the forces is what physics is all about, because if you know the forces and you know positions and velocities, you can effectively calculate the future of whatever the system is. And that's part of what you mean when you claim that you sort of understand what's going on. Right? So we're going to look initially at what happens with the forces. So that's why we're talking about Coulomb's law. That's in a sense what we mean. I mean, when we talk about how particles interact, that's what we mean when we talk about forces. So in this particular force, Coulomb's law seems to describe things. And so if we look at a system where we have different, say, Q1, a Q2, a Q3, and some Qn, all right, so other charges that are out there that could have any form you wish, this Q1, relative to the initial Q, little q, would be at a vector R1. Q2 might be specified, its position might be specified by a vector R2. Q3 has its position specified by vector R3, and Qn might be some vector R(n). Okay, and you can have any number of charges. And the force, the net force on this little charge Q, this little test charge that we put in space and sort of are using to probe to figure out what's going on, the net force on that due to this discrete system of large Qs then is going to be equal to the vector sum of the force on little q due to Q1 plus the force due to Q2 plus the force due to Q3 plus on up to the force due to Qn. And this is a vector sum. Right, so you have to remember that they don't add as numbers. So that means that the first piece, this force due to Q1, is equal to K times Q1 times little q over the square of the vector R1, that is the magnitude of R1 squared, in the direction of R1. The second term is k times q2 times little q over r2 squared in the direction of r2. And the last term is kqn q over rn squared times rn hat. Okay, and again, just emphasize this is a vector sum. Software is acting up today. So you okay with that? Now, the world is not discrete for the most part. You can think of the world as also having within it continuous charge distributions. So if we imagine that we have our little q here, and let's just put it at the origin of some Cartesian coordinate system, and then we have some potato of charge up here, some just sort of arbitrarily shaped thing, okay? Then the question is, how can we calculate what the force is on this little q when we have some sort of smoothly varying charge distribution over here, right? I cannot consider this as a point. And yeah, so life is difficult. So here's the game. The way to do this is you think, okay, I don't know what to do with the potato. But if I were to consider that potato to be broken up into a large number of little discrete charges, for each of those little discrete charges, I know exactly what to do. All right? So let's ignore the fact that we have a potato for a moment, and we'll just choose some arbitrary little piece of this potato. All right, so I'm going to choose a little cube in here. And because I have chosen a really little tiny piece of charge, because I want it to be basically point-like, it's a differential. And I call it dq. Okay? Now I have exactly the situation that we've had in the past, which is I have a point charge, and I have a point charge at that point. And I know how to deal with that. So I know that if I choose the position of this dq to be given by this vector r, I know how to write the force that is on little q due to dq. The force on q due to dq, it's a vector, and it's going to be equal to k times the size of q times the size of the differential charge, which is dq, over r squared, that's the distance, times r hat, which is exactly what we've been doing for discrete charges. Okay? The issue is, this isn't really the force on q, because it's given by this little dq. So in order to represent the fact that it's not a full force, but it's a little tiny differential contribution of the force, I call it a df. Okay, it's not the full force, it's just a little contribution of the force from this continuous potato crush. This contribution coming from one little piece. And you okay with that? Alright. So to get the full force, I now do that very thing for all the infinite other little pieces in this potato. And I sum them up vectorially. And that's what we call an integral. So the force on little q due to this continuous charge distribution is equal to the integral of all these little dfs as I integrate over the volume of this thing. Okay? If this thing is a sphere, I have to integrate over the full volume of the sphere. If it's a line, I integrate over the line. Okay? That's how it works. You alright with that? Okay. Anytime you're doing a continuous problem, this is sort of the thinking that you want to do. I don't know how to deal with a continuous thing. It's changing smoothly. It could vary all over the place as I'm going through it. But if I take a little tiny piece of it, I can treat it like a discrete thing, and I know how to write down the answer for that. And then I have to sum up the rest of it, which is the integral. So that's how you sort of think about setting these things up. You'll see it again and again and again as we go through the semester, so I hope you'll begin to get the hang of it. Many of you have done a lot of calculus. I hope all of you have done a lot of calculus already. But the thing about the math classes is that they don't usually give you an intuitive feel for what you're actually doing with integrals. And I hope that you pick that up here a little bit in thinking about how we're doing this, okay? All right, so I'm going to put off for a moment doing an example with this, which will make it feel much more real to you, I think, when I start doing some examples. I'm going to put off for that for a minute because I wanted to talk about a couple of other things, and then we'll come back and do examples. So one thing that may bother you a little bit is the fact that I have this little dq. And if you look carefully, what this integral is over dq. So I don't even know how to do that very easily. So you don't actually usually see these things where the integral is over dq. Still, this is how you have to think about it. Okay? So what do you get? What you normally get is that you're given that dq is equal to some charge distribution, which is a function of position in the potato, times dv. So what it's telling you is, here it's easy to think about it being dq, because that's how you know how to write down Coulomb's law. The problem is, what you'll be given isn't dq. What you'll be given is how dq changes from place to place. And that's what this gives you. So this is a function that picks a little differential volume, and then depending on where that volume is, it tells you what dq is by this function. This is called the charge density, the volume charge density. That makes sense? Okay. If it's a three-dimensional object, the symbol that we use is rho. And it's going to be rho times dv, where dv is really a three-dimensional thing. If it's a two-dimensional thing, so if it's a surface, like an infinite plate or something like that, then the charge gets distributed in a two-dimensional thing, and the symbology sort of changes, even though conceptually it's sort of the same thing. Let's see if I can make room for this. Yikes. That didn't work. It's not going to work. Okay. If you have a, if it's a 2D surface, surface of a sphere, surface of a plane, whatever, then dq is equal to sigma dA, where dA would be a little differential piece of area. And sigma now is going to be the area of charge density. So it tells you how the charge is spread over the surface. If it's a line, like a wire, if I scribble to such an extent that you can't actually read it, please call me on it. Especially if I get in a hurry, it starts going. I would say it goes south, but I'm from North Carolina, so that's not too cool. So it just gets where you can't read it. So if it's a line, then dq is equal to lambda dl, where dl is a differential piece of a line. So sometimes if you read a problem and you're a little confused about the geometry, but it gives you the charge distribution function, if it says rho, then it is a volume that you're talking about. So if for example, they draw a sphere, okay, and you're like, oh, is it a volume of the sphere? Is that where the charge is and throughout the sphere? Or is it just on the surface? If they give you sigma in terms of rho, it's a volume. If they give you sigma in terms of, I'm sorry, if they give you the charge density in terms of rho, it's a volume. If they give you the charge density in terms of sigma, it means it's distributed on the surface. So sometimes it's just a clue to let you know what they're really talking about. Okay? Yes?
So rho, sigma, so that's that part of the
You're asking me, are rho, sigma, lambdas, are those constants in the integral? That's a fabulous question. To some of you, they will always be constants because they're not necessarily constants, but I find when I give exams, people like to make that assumption because it makes the problem easier. These are arbitrary functions. They describe where the charge is in terms of a volume, where it is along the line. I could have a line where I have a lot of charge here and no charge here, which means these are now mathematical functions of the position. Okay? What you will typically see is something like the volume will change as a function of radius within the sphere. I'm sorry, the charge density will change as a function of radius in the sphere. The charge density may change as to where you are in the line. So lambda might be, for example, some constant times x, which would mean you would have no charge at the origin, but then you would have k times x at some position x as you go to either side on the line. So that would be the charge varying as a function of. And so when that happens, what that means is you can't, dq changes to rho dv or sigma dA or lambda dL in here. If lambda or rho or sigma is a function of position, you can't pull it out of the integral. So your integral can become complicated. That's how you describe this distribution of charge. Did that help? Okay, that's the hard part in this, okay? You will very often see a constant charge distribution because then it's easy. If I give you a sphere and I tell you, here's the charge density and it's constant within the sphere, then your rho or your sigma or your lambda or whatever pulls right out of the integral and life is easy. And in this class, that is probably the majority of what you will see, but I guarantee you that I will give you a continuously changing charge distribution. You'll have to identify it and do a different integral. Okay, so you'll have to get good at that. So this, I hope, will be more obvious as we go later on. Okay, again, I promised to do examples, but I wanted to push on this a little bit further before I start doing an example. So we started talking in class last time about how it is that some charge here produces a force on some charge here, which is at some point P. And you've already seen examples of this in gravitation. I don't know how much you guys talked about it. No, let me just back up. Let's not worry about comparing it to gravity yet. So we have a question as to what is the exact nature of this force, whatever's happening, that we're describing with the Coulomb force formula. Okay, that's not telling you what the essence of the force is. It's not giving you a concept of how to think about the force. That's just quantifying what the force does at any given point. All right. So what I'd like to do is to sort of create a mental model of the force and how it works. And I would like to, in a sense, make it depend only on the particle, on one of the particles. So let me just show you what I mean.
Let us imagine that at point P, which is at some position given by the vector r away from charge q, let us say that q creates in the space around it an electric field. And the electric field at some point p is equal to the force that you would have if you put a positive little test charge at that point divided by the charge itself, magnitude. So this would be equal to kq, little q, over r squared times r hat divided by the magnitude of q. So you might ask me, why am I doing this? This doesn't look any easier. So what we're saying is a couple of things. First of all, I take the force that's between what would be two charges here, and I'm dividing out the magnitude of one of the charges. So you'll note that it doesn't matter. The electric field doesn't care what the magnitude of the test charge is here. It only cares about what this charge is, because I divide out the magnitude of that charge. So what we're doing when we do that, the force depends on both charges. What we're doing when I divide out the magnitude of this charge is I now have something that depends only on this first charge. And now, conceptually, it's very different. I'm no longer talking about the force between two charges. I'm talking about what it is that this charge does to the space around it. So it now depends only on that one charge. And what we say is this charge creates a field, an electric field, in the space around it, such that if I put some other charge here, there is a force on it. Okay? And that's now the concept of a force in this classical physics. You sort of think of it as a field that's somehow emanating from this charge. Okay? Turns out to be very powerful, because now we only need to worry about this particular charge and not what we're doing with the test charge. So we define the electric field as the force per unit charge on a positive Q test charge. At each point, at each given point. So now, I think somehow when I first throw that out at you, it may sound a little bit strange, but you're actually very used to it in a lot of ways. What is a field? A field is a mathematical description where you correlate something on a point-to-point basis in all of reality. So you could imagine a temperature field would be where we create a mathematical model such that for every point in this room we assign a temperature, which corresponds to the temperature that you would measure in the room. It's not going to be the same number throughout the room, because we don't have a perfectly uniform temperature throughout this room. So it's going to vary some. And if we basically have, if you imagine that there exists a mathematical description
of how that temperature varies from point to point to point in the room, I can pick a point and I can tell you the temperature there is, you know, such and such, and the temperature here is such and such. That would be a mathematical field. You're used to seeing it every time you look at the weather. Right? You look at the weather map, and what do you see? It's as if somebody picked out a few points in the temperature field, and they tell you what they are, to give you a sense of how the temperature is varying across the state, for example. Okay? So that would be what we call a scalar field, because it only gives you a number corresponding to each point. It is an absolute temperature. Another field might be topographically, you know, what is the height above sea level for every point in the state? And you can come up with a number for each of those. That's a number. All right? If your mission that day wasn't to walk, so you care about the height or how cold it was, but it was that you wanted to fly, then you might worry about the wind speed and direction. So you could imagine now, if you go to the FAA website, in fact, you can find really fabulous maps that are similar to this, but instead of temperature, what they will give you is something that represents the wind in the state at some height or something. Okay? In which case, now you need something that represents the magnitude of the wind speed, and that might be the length of one of these little vectors, and the wind can vary in direction. It's very relevant if you're flying. And so you make the arrow point in the direction that the wind is blowing. And so you can then visualize, you can imagine creating a wind field in all of space around New York, where at each point you have a little vector, the length of which tells you how fast the wind is blowing there, and the direction tells you the direction which is going, okay? So that's a field. So now we have what we call an electric field. It's really a lot like the wind field, except what we're saying is I put a little test charge at this point. There will be a force on it. The arrow represents the magnitude of that force, and the direction of the arrow represents the direction of the force on that charged particle. You okay with that? All right. One of the things that makes 114 a little harder than 113 is you have to visualize these things. So one of the things that you'll be constantly doing is looking at some distribution of charges and trying to visualize what the forces are on the various charges. And one of the ways to do that is to sort of think about what does the electric field look like around different things. So let's look at how you might do that. I have a charge here, big Q. If I put a little test charge here, let's say big Q is positive, for example, then there will be a force on it which goes out that way. If I put little Q over here that's maybe about twice as far away, you'll have a force on it that's in the same direction but four times less. So it looks something like that. If I put the little test charge here, it's going to go that way. If I put it here, it's going to go that way. If I put it here, it's going to go that way. Okay? So mentally, you can put little test charges in various places. If I put it really close, it's going to be out radial, but it's going to be big because it's very close. All right? So I can imagine that around this charge Q, if I redraw it here, there exists an electric field where the lines of the electric field point out radially, and I now call these the lines of force, or this might be what you would imagine calling the electric field lines. And note now I've sort of made it continuous. So you mentally figure out what these look like by going through this sort of exercise. But when you draw them like this, the density of these lines represents the force. So if
you think about what's happening, if I draw a circle here, the density of these lines drops off. It actually will drop off as 1 over r squared for a spherical problem as you go further and further away. So if I draw lots of electric field lines beside each other, it's a very strong electric field. If I now place a charge at any point in this space, the force that's on it will be parallel to the electric field lines at that point. Okay? Any questions? Suppose this charge is negative. The symmetry is the same. It will be along radial lines. There's nothing else to mess that up. But now the electric field is going to go this way. So I could represent the electric field for a negative point charge by that. Let's suppose I have a plus Q here and a minus Q here. Now what's the electric field going to look like? The way to think your way through that is you mentally place little test charges around to see what happens. So if I put a little test charge right here, if it's a positive charge, it will be repelled from this. It will be attracted by that. So there will be an electric field line. The electric field at that point is going to look like that. If I put the point up here, this positive Q is going to be pushing it away radially from it, okay, like that. The negative Q is going to be attracting it like that. If these have the same magnitude and they're the same distances away, those forces are going to be equal in magnitude. So I'll have something like the positive Q will give me that. The negative Q will give me something like that. And note that the up and down components of these two forces will cancel out. And I end up with... something that looks like that. If I put the test charge over here, it's going to be pushed to the left by big Q. It'll be pulled to the right by minus Q. But the big Q is much closer, so it wins. Right? The force that's being pushed by big Q is much, much greater than that where it's being pulled. So the field will go out this way. Similarly, over here, the field is going to come in like that. If I go here, big Q, the plus Q is going to push big over this way, like that. The minus Q is going to pull it, but it's going to be small because I'm far away. So it's going to be something like that. And that will end up giving me an electric field line that looks like this. Okay? So you just go through that exercise if you need to. And what you end up finding will be something that looks a lot like this. The electric field lines will look something like that. And this would be a dipole form of the electric field lines that can fit in this. Okay with that? I have two positive particles, for example, and I put them together so they have the same charge. Now things are going to look a bit different. For example, if I put a charge right in the middle, the net electric field is zero. So what you find is that you'll have field lines that do something like this.
So whatever the geometry is, you want to be able to think your way through what the field lines might look like. And now at this point, if I take any other charge, a little test charge, and I want to know what's going to happen to it when I put it in the space around these two, I plop it here, the charge is going to move parallel to the electric field line at that point. That will be the direction of the force on it. Okay? Are we all excited about this stuff now? Okay. So, some of you may have noticed in Physics 113, sometimes it wasn't a good idea to sort of cut corners on like Newton's law problems and stuff. You actually really did want to take your time and sum the forces along each of the directions and all this kind of stuff. So, this is sort of similar in the sense that you really want to think your way through what's happening in the problems, and very often that may entail actually sitting down and thinking, okay, now what is the electric field going to look like on this thing? Lest you think I'm full of crap, I'm going to do a demo. Let us suppose I have a bead of material and I put it in an electric field. Note, I just slipped one past it. You know, a moment ago, we sort of pulled this electric field out of thin air. We made it up because it takes out this other charge or whatever. Now, we have an electric field in space. I don't care how it got there. We sort of divorced things from the charge that's created. We now have a characteristic of space, which we will call the electric field. And I can just talk about that. So let there be an electric field in space, and I don't need to know how it got there. I know I can make one by putting charges over here on the left side if I wish, but I don't care. So you'll now begin to see I don't have to specify some charge distribution, I'll just specify the electric field. So even though we've started out by just pulling it out of thin air, I hope that you will begin to think of it as something that feels more real and develop sort of a mental model to begin to think about. So there exists an electric field in space, and it happens to be in the region where there is this material. This material is made up of different charges. So what's going to happen if the charges are allowed to move? Let us suppose that this material is a conductor. In fact, let me redraw it a little bit. So I have in space, so this one arrow represents sort of the electric field in all of space here. So it's that direction and magnitude no matter where I am in here. And let us suppose that I now have a big something that's not pink. So I have some material. Let's say that it is a conductor. What's going to happen? If you are an electric, first of all, it's a conductor. When you hear the word conductor, that means charge moves freely. It is not stuck, it's not taped to the surface of this thing or the volume of this thing. Yeah. So charges will separate. Why? Because there's a force on them. Why? Because there's an electric field in that part of space. So if there's an electric field like this on the conductor,
if you have a positive charge somewhere in that conductor, in this metal, right? So I have a positive charge sitting here in the midst of this chunk of metal. What happens to it? Well, there's an electric field in space there, so it's going to respond to that. There's a force on it, which means it moves. So it's going to go over here. If I have a negative charge in the middle of that space, what's going to happen to it? There's an electric field there, so there's a force on it, and it's going to be taking it back along the electric field line. So this one sort of moves over that way, that one moves over that way. Okay? And this will just keep going until you have separated a bunch of charge, and it will keep going. The charge will keep moving until the charge has arranged itself in such a way that I have the external electric field. Internally, I have an electric field that's going like so, because I've separated the charge, so that separated charge now has an electric field itself. That charge will move until the vector sum of that external electric field and the internal electric field cancel out identically to zero. If it's not zero, the charge moves. So the charge just moves around until you get it to be zero. So what that means is, if I have a conductor and I plop it down in an electric field, I may very well have that external electric field out here, but in here, the electric field is identically zero. Because if it's not, charges move until it is. Don't want to make it look like not equal to zero. Okay, so even if you have an external field, the electric field inside the conductor is identically zero. Okay? So that's one thing we'll talk about. Now let's suppose that we have a substance that isn't a conductor. Generally, we call those substances, you might think that we would call them non-conductors, and we do sort of, but that really doesn't sound cool enough. So we generally call them dielectrics. Sounds better, right? So if we have a dielectric, what it means is that the charge might move a little bit. Yeah.
So what do you mean when you say the electric field equals zero?
What I mean when I say the electric field equals zero is that if you were to take a test charge and put it in the middle of that conductor, there would be no force on it. So that's sort of my definition of what the electric field is. What I mean conceptually is, if I have a chunk of metal and I put it in an electric field, by virtue of there being an electric field there, it will move charges around. And since the charges are free to move, they'll basically move around until the field that the charges themselves cause cancels out the external field, so that inside you have charges of zero, a field of zero, so that nothing moves. So non-conducting materials, think of it as, you know, rubber or glue or water or something like that. They might conduct a little bit, but unless they're like metallic, we don't really call them conductors. We call them dielectrics instead. A dielectric, you may get a little bit of a charge separation, but you won't get a full charge separation. So the way to think about it is, the charges are not completely freely moving, but they can move a little bit. So what will happen is, you will get a little bit of
polarization happening here. And in fact, if I have a big external field, that polarization will neglect, cause some of that electric field to be canceled on the inside. So inside this material, you will get a reduced electric field. So we'll study that quantitatively at one point. But I really just wanted to bring this up for the demo. Because one of the things that will happen if I put like a polystyrene bead or something in an electric field is you'll get a small charge separation. So it's like you have a little dipole. So let us suppose that I have a sort of a lucite glass which has a space in between, and in that space I have a lot of little polystyrene beads, which I conveniently put where you can't see it. Okay? So you can actually see the beads, right? And they can move around. And they have this one, this big thing is not a bead, it's just something that goes and moves all the other beads around to randomize their position. So it's the little things that we're talking about that swirl around a little bit. And then what I have here is a piece of plexiglass on which we have got a metallic strip coated, and I have a device which allows me to basically, if you think of it as a battery, it allows me to, it's designed to rub two dissimilar materials together as I spin it, and allows the charge that I remove from one material to basically build up. So it's called a wind burst machine. It basically allows me to separate charge and put positive charge on one thing and negative charge on the other. I hook wires to them such that I now will put positive charge on one of these and negative charge on the other. Okay? And if I do that, then you can imagine what will happen if I put a little test charge in the middle here. Let's suppose I have positive charge on this one and negative charge on that one. This little test charge is going to have an electric field on it. It's going to have a force on it, which is going straight from the right to the left. So if I were to draw the electric field lines for this configuration, I will have straight lines going from here to there, here to there, here to there, here to there. Okay? So let's see what happens if I take these polystyrene beads, which are in some random configuration, and I basically put them in that space. Okay, you see what's going on? There's an electric field there. The polystyrene beads will then get a little separation of charge. So they'll line up because they're all little dipoles. And some of them will even, because, well, I'll do the same thing here. These little dipoles will line up along the electric field lines. So you can see them sort of lining up, looking a lot like that dipole that we drew on the board a minute ago. Okay, it going to look like here? Anything? Sorry, I have a fan right here. What?
Does this experiment change based on the weather? Because now it's so dry, what's the plan is anymore?
Yeah, so the question is, does this change depending on the weather? And the answer is yes. If it's a very humid day, it's much harder to build the charges up because it bleeds off into the air. So in fact, you'll find the success rate of my demos will depend a lot on the humidity. And I can almost guarantee you there will be some that will not work at all as we go through the semester. Okay, so here's a different one. We're going to charge the inner circle one charge, the outer circle another charge. So you might expect the field lines to basically go along the radial lines from the inner to the outer. Let's see what happens. Work, I have shorted it out. Oh, okay. Still sort of work. I was building up one. Okay. Anyway, it worked, but you can sort of see the field lines now. So although we sort of invented the concept in a sense, I hope you can see that it's useful. Very nice and real. You can sort of imagine, ask yourself, what do the field lines look like? You can think, okay, if I put this stupid little bead dipole on there, how is it going to line up? All right, you good with that? At the risk of doing one that really does suffer from humidity, but we might be able to work it out this time. See what we can do with this other one. Start out for this one by telling you that I have two balls, but I thought that might be inappropriate to share. There are here two metallic balls, and if I deposit charge on this rod, whatever it is, and I touch it on this rod, this ball, I have deposited charge on the ball. And hopefully, as it approaches this electroscope, the electroscope moves because this has charge of a certain sign. It shoves charge of the same sign down onto the pole and the gold foil. And now the gold foil and the pole all have charges of the same kind, so the gold foil moves away. Okay? Now, what I'd like to do is to start out with the following situation. I have two conducting balls here that are touching. I will now approach this situation with a charged rod. I don't actually know if it's positive. We'll just say it's positive right now. When I do that, what's going to happen? What will happen to the charges on these two metal balls when I come and approach it with this rod? What do you think?
The negative charges will be pulled into the ball that's closer to the rod and when you turn on the light.
Okay. So the charges are free to move. I come at it with something positive. That means there's an electric field in this space, so it will cause the charges to move. So the positive rod will push positive charges away from it. They'll come over here, and negative charges will come over here. Okay? If I now remove the rod and the balls are in touch with each other, the charges just redistribute back in, and nothing exciting happens. Alright? But now, suppose that I approach it like this, and while the rod is there, I move the two balls away from each other. Oh, what happened there? So time passes. And I move these things away from each other while the rod is still sitting there. Then time passes, and I just remove the rod. And when that happens, sometimes this thing is worth it, sometimes it is not. So I take the rod, I approach the two conducting system that separates the charge. I then, while the rod is in the vicinity so the charge stays separated, I move the two balls apart. That leaves charge on each of the two balls. It can't flow anymore. I now remove the rod, so there is no electric field there that's causing the charge to be separated, but they're now on different balls. So we call this thing charging by induction. You can say we're inducing charge separation by this external thing. So let's just sort of look at this and see how it works. Okay? So I now have a charged rod. The balls are touching each other. I come into the vicinity. Alright? I haven't touched it. I now separate the balls. I move the rod way over here. So now I have one ball. And I look right here, I didn't mean to touch it, but I did. All right, so it's charged. I touched it to this thing, so it's now deposited charge on the electroscope. If this charging by induction works, this ball has to have the opposite charge, which means when it approaches, that should lower. And you see that it does. Okay? So charge comes in two types, and that's very cool. Have a great weekend.
Send an email to the classroom.